The Italian still life master Giorgio Morandi is often described as a painter's painter, although he's generally little understood by the general public. Recently, New Yorkers have been given a rare opportunity to see why he's revered by so many of his fellow artists through two major exhibitions. One at the Center for Italian Modern Art in Soho features around 40 paintings, etchings, and drawings rarely seen from the 1930s, the decades when Morandi reached full artistic maturity and developed his distinctive pictorial language. And an exhibition of 20 paintings dating from 1941 to 1962 is at David Zwirner's Gallery in Chelsea. Together, the two presentations explore Morandi's far-reaching impact and legacy, particularly within the context of the United States as an important forerunner of post-war American art. It's with great pleasure that I welcome Heather Ewing, CIMA's executive director, and David Lieber, the director of the David Zwirner Gallery and organizer of its Morandi exhibitions, to our show today. Hello.
Nice to be here.
Now, he died in 1964, and as I remembered, he was quite popular with American collectors when he was alive. So why, except for a retrospective at the Metropolitan Museum of Art 7 years ago, has he largely disappeared from public view in this country until now? David?
Well, I think he's an artist who's beloved in Italy. He's sort of a national treasure there. If you go to Bologna, one of the pilgrimages one might make would be to Bologna, to the Museo Morandi. There have been many shows in Europe, but oddly, there haven't been gallery exhibitions in America in many years. There was, as you mentioned, the show at the Met in 2008. And I think there's a hunger to see his work in a more contemporary context. And when I was thinking about this exhibition for David Zwirner and talking with Laura Mattioli, who was planning this earlier exhibition on the earlier work, I thought it'd be fascinating to really focus on late Morandi, which was his most prolific period. And it was a body of work that was immensely important on this later generation of artists in the 60s.
And then, Heather, your gallery took care of all the other stuff, but also includes some of the later work.
Yes, we have works from the 1910s, the very beginning of Morandi's career, and also from the very end of his life, the 1960s, to provide a kind of context for
this. Do you see a through line? Do you see the same man in the early work as you see in the late work?
Well, I think one of the things that's fascinating to see those works is to be able to think about the things that are different, but also the continuities in the objects and in his approaches.
Do you think that one of the problems some people have is the subject matter? Most of his paintings are tabletop still lives of bottles, boxes, vases, jars, and flowers. They obviously fascinated him a lot, but people often want big statements in paintings.
Right. I think sort of the discipline of his art and his commitment to this very generic, in a way, still life genre, and the fact that he stuck with it his entire life is a kind of inspiration, especially for artists. And he, in a way, these objects enchanted him, but they also, these paintings sort of enchant us. The theme and variation and the endless expressiveness that he could create from these mundane objects and transform them through these paintings, that explains their more universal appeal.
I think, too, that one of the things that we've tried to do in the show at CIMA is to, we have these works by Joel Meyerowitz in one of our rooms.
A great photographer.
A great American photographer who spent some time in Morandi's studio in Bologna, one of these people who made that pilgrimage, earlier this year, and he photographed all 270 objects. And we have a selection of those on view. And it offers this incredible opportunity to understand the actual things that Morandi painted, because he isn't really depicting them necessarily in a real way. He's using them to think about how we see and how we can describe things. And so you see these objects that he's actually worked on before he even starts to paint. So the bottles are painted themselves, or he's poured paint inside of them. And in some cases, he's even fabricated the object. They're not just found things. And we do have one object as well on display, which is one of these things that he's created. It looks like an oil can, but it's actually, it has no bottom and it has a flat back. You can see around to the back. And
it was like a stage set.
Yes, very much so.
He wrote in a 1957 letter, "The only interest the visible world awakens in me concerns space, light, color, and form." So can we say that the actual subject of his paintings was largely irrelevant? Were his real concerns just subtle shifts in color, tone, scale, composition, geometry, mark making, the act of painting itself?
I think so. I mean, yes. At the gallery, what's been fascinating to see, you know, most people look at contemporary art, they're moving quickly through a space. They see an image from across the room, and the David Zwirner show, it's been amazing, the numbers of people coming, and they look at these paintings like they're Vermeer paintings, and they sort of stand in front of them. They're very rewarding the longer you look. They depict another world, and you sort of almost want to enter into this world. In a way, these objects are almost like characters on a stage, and so you become very aware of how close the objects are, the relationships between, in a way, the figures, how the tops of the objects might sort of merge into the background. They're endlessly fascinating. They change as you're looking at them, and that's an exciting phenomena.
We have some wonderful images from the exhibits on our show page at WNYC.org if listeners are unfamiliar with his work. One of his most famous sayings was, "Nothing is more abstract than reality."
Yes. I mean,
and it's only after you see the work that you understand what he meant
that,
by that.
He could have been an abstract painter if he was born 10 years later. That's very true.
He wasn't really interested in depicting the physical properties of the objects in a realistic way like the Dutch masters might have. Is this because also of his history? He was connected to the futurists at one point, and then people like Giorgio de Chirico and Carlo Cara, the metaphysical artists. Even though his work doesn't seem to belong to either of those schools, they must have influenced
him. I think that choice of still life, which is considered a kind of low art in a way, but it's also neutral, as David was saying, and it was the subject matter of choice for a lot of these avant-garde movements at the beginning of the century when he was a young man, like you were saying.
At times, he seems to have been more interested in the negative space, the space between the objects as the objects themselves.
I think so. I mean, the later work, what you see, my interest especially was that he began to work entirely in a serial nature. So for every painting, you'll see a range of related pictures using the same objects.
Are they in dialogue with each other?
Very much so. And in the studio, if you were to go to a studio in 1952, we have four paintings, for example, using the same objects from the so-called yellow cloth series. And these forms, what happens, I think, with the later period, is these objects are almost floating on the table, almost disappearing. And at the same time, we have downstairs an exhibition of Donald Judd's Corten works from the late 80s. Judd wrote about Morandi when he was a critic, and it's an interesting contrast, the sort of the weightiness of these objects downstairs, these boxes, and then you come up and you see Morandi's forms almost floating.
Well, so many artists have been cited as having been influenced by Morandi. Andy Warhol, Jasper Johns, Robert Ryman, Agnes Martin, Wayne Thiebaud, Philip Guston, Luke Tiemens, Donald Judd, Saul LeWitt, Dan Flavin.
It's a very long list.
It's kind of like the history of American conceptual artists.
Conceptual artists, not just painters like Thiebaud, but as you mentioned, the minimal generation.
And also Judd. Photographers.
And I photographers.
Mean, many photographers.
And
yes.
Then the people in the light and space movement like Robert Irwin.
Indeed.
Now, let's talk a bit about the circumstances of these exhibits. First of all, I'm so sorry that we're talking about this just 2 days before the Zwirner Gallery exhibit closes.
Yes.
Saturday's the last day, David?
Tomorrow is the last day, unfortunately. It was a show that I had been thinking about for quite some time, but we actually didn't really start working on it. We have a fantastic team at the gallery, unbelievable research department, and we could work very quickly. But we really started working on the show in February. I had been speaking with Laura about her plans, and it just seemed an ideal coincidence, in a way, to work together, have these shows open at the same time, and also have this show at the same time as the Judd show downstairs.
So they can, the David Zwirner Gallery is located at 537 West 20th Street in the gallery area in Chelsea. But the Center for Italian Modern Art is located at 421 Broome Street in Soho, and that exhibit continues until June 25th of next year. But Heather, don't people have to make special arrangements to see it?
We are open every Friday and Saturday. Our exhibitions each year last the entire academic year from October to June. And CIMA is primarily a research center, and we have a fellowship program. And so the exhibition is also meant to serve as a kind of platform for new ideas and study of the works. And so that's one of the reasons that it's up for such a long time.
So you have him as a subject of scholarship?
Yes,
as much as just the appreciation of the work.
That's right. I mean, it's a rare chance to learn in a different way about an artist. Art historians are often studying from archives and books, and instead here it's about what happens when you look at something for a long time.
Well, when you look at Morandi's life, he lived in Bologna. He was unmarried all his life, lived with his sisters in the same apartment all of his life.
He did. He was
rarely traveled down to Bologna.
Exactly. He was, you could say, a solitary who lived his life surrounded by people.
Although he taught.
On the one hand, he was very local, very much based in Bologna. He traveled within Italy, but only once to Switzerland briefly. And yet he did manage to oversee a very large network of dealers and exhibitions by the 50s. He had many shows in the United States. He never came to the United States. So he was this interesting combination of being very local, but someone whose work had, oddly, this universal broader appeal.
And he did go to see art a lot. He did travel within Italy, as David was saying, he would go with friends to see other exhibitions.
I see people like Piero della Francesca in his work. But he painted several landscapes and a few self-portraits, but none of the human figure. Heather, do we know why he avoided that?
Well, there are some, but he stops by about 1930, and that's one of the other things that's interesting about focusing on the 1930s. It's a period that's not so familiar, but I think this is when he commits to this investigation of painting through these objects.
There's a self-portrait in the show at CIMA where he's holding his brush in his left hand, and that's an interesting clue. When you're looking at his paintings, you parse them, you take them apart, and you look, and you're actually thinking, was this artist left-handed? Mm-hmm. He was, in fact. I don't know what significance that had, but somehow it feels like that's meaningful in his case.
Now, just one more question for both of you. Most of these paintings are already in collections, in museum collections, and in private collections. So when you're mounting a show like this at a gallery, what is the gallery gain by it? You're not going to be selling very many paintings.
I think the time frame I mentioned, really 8 months, was perfect. Just enough time to borrow work from institutions like the National Gallery. Many loans from European collectors, especially Italy and other parts of Europe, and some from a New York-based collection, several collectors. But then there were four or five pictures available for sale. And I think if I had approached colleagues who own these works 2 years ago and said, I'm doing a Morandi show in 2017, they'd say, sure, talk to me in a year. And it might not have happened. So in a way, the timing was very auspicious.
But in the case of CIMA, you're asking people to lend you these valuable paintings for almost a year.
A long time. More than half a year. It's 9 months. So it is a very, very long time. And we've been very lucky that people have been willing to do that. But I think understanding that a lot can happen during that time, especially with study, then it makes it more appealing.
So, David, people want to see your show. The address is 537 West 20th Street.
Yes, and As I said, as you mentioned, it unfortunately closes tomorrow, but we're planning a very interesting publication for next year coming from our own imprint, which so somehow the exhibition will live on, and I'm sure there will be other projects Mirandi-related that we'll be involved with.
And Heather, in your case, if people want to see the show, what do they have to do?
The best thing to do is to book on our website, italianmodernart.org. And our visits are at 11, 1, 3, and 5.
They're guided tours.
Guided visits. But there's time for you to be alone as well afterwards with the works.
And our show runs until June 25th of next
year.
Yes. It's at 421 Broome Street. Thank you both so much for being on our show, David Lieber and also Heather Ewing.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure talking about one of my favorite artists.
Thanks.